Next week, Eau Claire and cities across the U.S. will celebrate Juneteenth. It's a holiday commemorating the abolition of slavery in the last of the Confederate states. This hour, we'll preview that event with the organizers and talk about race in western Wisconsin, the state, and the nation as a whole. This is The West Side. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this beautiful Monday morning on Ideas 88.3 WHWC and 88.7 WRFW in River Falls. Joining me in the studio are three guests. In no particular order, they are Salika Dexworth-Lawton. She is a history professor specializing in U.S. history, U.S. social history, African-American history and military history at UW-Eau Claire. Welcome to the program, Salika.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Next, I'd like to welcome Nevaeh Lambert. She is a junior at Memorial High School in Eau Claire and a board member with the advocacy group Uniting Bridges. Nevaeh, welcome.
Welcome.
And I'd like to introduce Carrie Kincaid. She is the Eau Claire City Council President. Welcome to the program, Carrie.
Pleased to be here.
Good to have you. Mm-hmm. And joining us by phone is Pastor Jerome Smith, Sr. He is pastor at Greater Praise Church of God in Christ in Milwaukee and founder of the Joseph Project there. Pastor, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Good morning. Listeners, we'd love to hear from you. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call at 1-800-228-5615. We're going to be talking about the Juneteenth celebration, also what Juneteenth is, what it commemorates, the bigger issues surrounding, race, and we're going to also be talking about whether or not we're seeing issues of prejudice and or racism right in our own backyards. A lot of people like to think that it is not an issue that affects our area, but you may be surprised. So, if you've got a question or a comment, 800-228-5615. Salika, I'll start with you real quick for a historical primer on what Juneteenth is all about.
Well, Juneteenth is the celebration of the final freeing of the slaves in Galveston, which was the last place where slaves were finally told they were free. Slave owners did not volunteer the information. So even though the Second Emancipation Proclamation was proclaimed in April of 1865 and the war ended in April of 1865, the slaves in Galveston were not freed until June 19th, 1865, when General Granger arrived at the farthest corner and read General Order 100 to them, saying that they were free.
And that was that. I mean, but the Union Army was there to enforce?
The Union Army had to enforce the order. And ironically, everywhere in the Civil War, the Union Army was, slaves would flock to it. Mm. And when you look at the over 450 African-American men who fought for the Union Army, over half had been runaway slaves.
Sure.
Now, when we look at the number of white Southerners who fought for the Union Army, over 100,000 white Southerners fought for the Union Army out of loyalty to our American flag and to our American ideals.
Hmm.
So Juneteenth is a celebration of freedom. It's a celebration of the freeing of the slaves, but it's also a celebration of the role that our ideals and our military play in protecting our freedom. And the idea that we extend that freedom not based on race, we extend that freedom to all human beings. And this is one of the things that makes the U.S. and the U.S. Constitution very unique in this world.
I want to get a younger perspective here, so I'm going to go to Nevaeh Lambert. So, I mean, obviously, you're in high school. What does it mean to you? I mean, it might mean different things to different people that have more historical backgrounds, and et cetera, but how will you be celebrating and why?
I mean, Juneteenth to me, because of my racial background, coming from a family that was mixed, Juneteenth to me was always just that, like, coming together with people that were in a way like me and, like, getting to learn about my history, because I grew up without knowing much about my history and, like, knowing about what really happened. And at the age of, five, I think, was our first year at Juneteenth. And I got very interested in it. And ever since then, I've just, it's been a really huge part of my life. And I just really enjoy learning about it. And each year, like, something new comes up. Like, we will, one of us finds something new on the internet or something, so.
And tell us about your involvement with Uniting Bridges, the group in Eau Claire.
All right, so currently I'm the youngest member of Uniting Bridges, which
I would think so.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. Because I think it helps them bring a whole new insight to it and, like, really get that younger person's perspective and how we can reach to the youth. But, like, being in Uniting Bridges, it just gives me that feel that I'm really helping out our community and I'm spreading the word of how to give more diversity and more, I don't know, just more of happiness in a way.
Yeah? Well, it's you're bringing that to the studio right now, so... And thanks for participating in the program. And Pastor Smith, I'm wondering, so Juneteenth, will you be holding any celebrations in Milwaukee or attending any? And what does it mean to you beyond just the historical significance?
Well, for me, Juneteenth here in Milwaukee, we celebrate it. In downtown Milwaukee, we block off about a 6 or 8 block radius, and we have like a festival.
Cool.
And that festival is good food, good eating. Beverages, activities, concerts, and we enjoy one another. It's a time for family to come together and bond. It's time for community to come together and bond. Yes, all in celebration, the freedom of the slaves, the last slaves being notified, like you said, that they were actually free. Because let's face it, it took them 2.5 years to find that out.
And some people might assume that this is a, we've already kind of touched on this, but this is a holiday just for, you know, black people or people from diverse backgrounds or people of color. Is that incorrect?
I would think so. I would say so. Yes, it is about black folks being free, but a lot of people did not agree with some of the things that were going on back then, so we all celebrated together.
Salika?
And there were plenty of whites who fought for that freedom. There have always been white allies.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll point out that a number of those people were religious. You look at the, as Ida B. Wells called them, the sacred teachers who were Methodist, who were Lutheran, who were Baptist, who came down to teach the freed slaves. You look at the people of faith and religion who went into the human army to fight for freedom. Because as they read Matthew, and as they read the other books of the Gospels, in God there is no slave and free. In God there is no male or female. So you look at the secular people who felt that we could not be a nation divided. Juneteenth is for everyone.
Kerry Kincaid, according to the latest census data that I could find, the population of Eau Claire is very white, 92.3%, just more than 1% of the population identified as black or African-American alone. So why then does the city hold and commemorate events for Juneteenth?
Well, my short answer would be, why wouldn't we?
Right, of course.
We live in this geography called the city of Eau Claire, and here we are together, so we best get along.
Yeah.
And I think the city recognizes our lack of racial diversity. It doesn't mean that we don't seek more diversity or recognize that it's important to elevate the diversity that is here and increase it and celebrate it. The city council first proclaimed Juneteenth Day in 2001.
Oh,
and
wow.
We have proclaimed every year since that Juneteenth is an important day, highlighting the historical aspects that Dr. Duxworth brought to our attention, but also in little ways, if I can say that, by making sure there's a public space for the celebration and doing little things like waiving fees and
sure.
Little things that the public sector can do. And donating our time, city staff time, to help bring the celebration into fruition. And that has a real cost to it that was absorbed by the city and willingly so we could bring importance and a dignity to the celebration.
So then, you know, any one issue shouldn't, its importance is not dictated by the, you know, the population or, you know, those correlated, those numbers do not correlate directly. The importance is the importance.
I don't think it's, I don't think we can look for a numerical justification for anything we do in the public sector, or as we do as human beings, really. You can't look for some justification just out of numbers.
Right.
It's more important to do things because it's the right thing to do. To be honest about our history, and when I read the proclamation, it reads a few historical facts, so people hear out in the open, over the airways, and now on video and streaming, they hear facts and are reminded every year that that truth in our history.
And, you know, the issues, you know, and the problems, the challenges facing people of color in the United States are not, you know, nothing has been solved. We, after the election of the President Barack Obama, there were some discussions of a post-racial kind of a U.S., which a lot of people kind of scoffed at because America definitely still has its challenges. And I wanted to kind of go around Robin a little bit, and I'll start with Pastor Jerome Smith Sr. down in Milwaukee. What do you see as one of the major challenges facing black people, people of color, or people just with some backgrounds that, you know, might have cause them issues with regard finding a job or something like that, Pastor?
Well, when you look at unemployment, we rat and rave about having a very low unemployment rate. But when you take in consideration the African-American community, that unemployment rate is much, much, much higher than the rate that we actually proclaim. And so when you think about that, a lot of that is driven because we have barriers. We have barriers such as we may not have the transportation to get us there. We may not have the education that's considered. We may not have the skill set for that position. And instead of someone coming in saying, I'm willing to figure out how to get you there, I'm willing to invest the time in training you, much like she said, there were white folks back in those days that came in and taught them to read. And some of that is kind of gone away today. So people are not as vested in building up the community as they used to be. The community used to be driven by the church. It's not driven by the church anymore. And now, I mean, for me, I feel blessed because we've done something with this thing called the Joseph Project that's unheard of. You've got a white lawmaker, a good friend of mine, U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, who co-founded the Joseph Project with me. So when you take in consideration you have this white guy and this black guy teaming up to remove those barriers that's hindering black folk, white folks, and any other folks that's fighting this barrier of getting to work, because let's be realistic. We can really say, yes, it's a black thing, it's an African-American thing, that these guys are having problems finding jobs. But I found out that even with that, there are some other folks out here that have some similar problems that are not considered worthy of the job. And that's what it comes down to. Are we considered worthy of the job? Give us a chance. Let us show you that we can work. Let us show you that we want to work. Let us show you that we will work. That's my outlook on it.
And I love the outlook. I wanted to ask you one question before we kind of go into how the Joseph Project is helping with that. But I wanted to ask, you know, the President Donald Trump has been vocal about how, you know, he's been citing figures saying black unemployment is in the nation is at its lowest level in history. In Twitter messages, he's all but taking credit for this phenomenon. But so, you know, you mentioned that it's still an issue, and it's still much higher than the overall unemployment rate. But is it improving?
Slowly but surely. But it's still much higher than white America, basically.
Right. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, I wanted to finish the round robin and then go back into the Joseph Project, but what do you see as one of the major issues, one of the challenges, et cetera, facing people of color?
For middle-class blacks who are qualified, we have to face discrimination, especially in majority white environments. Mm-hmm. The pastor is talking about a segregated environment that is majority African-American or majority multicultural. My children operate in a majority white environment. And one of the biggest things that they have to face and middle-class blacks have to face is false accusation. And you saw that with the Starbucks case. You saw that with the golfing case. Mm-hmm. We've been seeing a lot of those cases. And that leads us to a cycle where you have a qualified black person who is trying to live their life, who is trying to get a job, and they're facing what's called covert discrimination. So covert discrimination means you can be qualified and you still won't get that job. Covert discrimination means you can be waiting and you will now have a police encounter, which will be a barrier to you getting a job, or which will bring you into the criminal justice system. If you have enough money, you can fight it, as the football player who is in California is doing, who was falsely arrested for breaking into a trailer. Mm-hmm. He was looking at to buy for his mother-in-law. And we've been joking all weekend he could buy that entire trailer park and evict the caller. Mm-hmm. You know, the police are already apologizing. So when you're dealing with those kind of situations in a majority white environment, the barriers are not that you don't have self-help and you don't have an education. That's a working class issue, and that's very much an urban issue. That's Milwaukee, and it makes a lot of sense there. But where I am, we face issues of false accusation, discrimination, covert discrimination, and stereotyping. My son, for instance, had an encounter, I'm not going to say who with, to protect the guilty. An individual who tried to talk him into taking the circuit class at Memorial instead of taking Algebra 2. My son wants to be a civil engineer. I had to intervene in that situation. And this person did not realize I had a PhD and tried to tell me that with the circuit class instead of Algebra 2, he'd be accepted into colleges. I've sat on admission boards. That's not true. So you have parents who aren't going to have that kind of knowledge, and they will be. And there's several books and pieces of research. The biggest one is called Crossing the Finish Line, where multicultural students tend to be steered away from the classes that they need by well-meaning people, but then they can't get through the gateways to get to the careers they want.
Nevaeh, What have you faced any sort of situations or challenges that maybe your white schoolmates have not?
I faced one this year, and I'm not sure if it was completely that or if it was something else, but the teacher was very hated to me. Oh. Like, anything that I did wasn't ever right. Like, I would answer questions and it wasn't right. But I have noticed with a lot of my other black schoolmates that it is a thing. Where, like, the teacher won't find them smart, and I've talked to them, and I know that they're smarter, but the teacher has that stereotype that they're never going to be a good student or they're never going to be good enough, because I have many friends that have been held back from taking Algebra 2 because they don't have the smarts according to the teachers.
And that's interesting, as Salika mentioned, that even in some situations where someone is trying to be well-meaning, it can come off as and have real negative impacts. Pastor Jerome Smith Sr. is going to have to leave us at 10:30. So I wanted to talk about, you mentioned this Joseph Project that you've co-founded with Senator Ron Johnson. Tell me, how are you helping break down those barriers to employment specifically? I think you're offering educational classes, and tell us how that works.
So it's real sweet, and it goes back to what the doctor was referring to, how people with criminal backgrounds, may be hindered from employment. And so we help navigate around that background issue. We help those guys that may have some issues in their backgrounds get a job. We help them understand their situation and realize and learn and grow from their mistakes. And then we're able to package that up and present that and show them how to talk for themselves and stand up for themselves. And what's unique is most of these classes, probably 95% of our workshops, are all taught by veterans. All veterans, men and women who have served our country, have volunteered their time They come in, they spend the time to teach them. And then we move that barrier of transportation, because what we discovered is that, much like she was referring to, in the suburban areas, things are a little bit better. The grass seem to be a little bit greener out there. You have greater jobs out there. You have jobs that pays livable wages. The problem goes back to, okay, I'm in Milwaukee. How do I get to a Sheboygan? How do I get to a Horicon? So the church comes in. The church comes in and provides transportation. The transportation gets them to work and from work. We don't charge them anything up front. We give them the first 30 days free. After that, we charge them a minimum fee of like $10 a day to help pay the cost of transportation. And we move that barrier. When there's a situation going on with them on the job, we mentor them. We give them spiritual guidance to help them get through. Because like Murphy Law, anything that can go wrong will go wrong. And it's not always easy. Yes, you're going out to a whole other community, a whole other group of people that may not be as diverse as you would like them to be, and they may not see you. And everybody in that plant may not even want you there. And so we spend time with conflict resolution teaching them how to deal with that. So we spend a lot of time, effort, and energy, and we do all this at no cost. And we don't take a dime. So that everybody's perfectly clear. We don't take a dime of government funding. We're not funded by the federal government, the state government, or local government. All of our funding that we get comes from local people who are careful and concerned for the people. And it's not a black thing or a white thing. What the Joseph Project does is a people thing. We actually help people.
So, Pastor, I wanted to ask you before you have to leave us, do you think that a church-based approach, community-based approach through the churches may be more effective than certain types of government assistance, whether it be, you know, food stamps or work training, whatever?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can tell you without any uncertainty that Joseph Project's been around since September of 2015. We've put about 400 people through the class, and about 278 has gotten jobs. And out of that 278, more than 75 to 80% of them are people who were on public assistance, who are no longer on public assistance. Now they're paying for their own health insurance. They're getting better health insurance. They're not on food stamps. And they're not getting any type of rent assistance. And so now they're paying their bills, they're putting food on their table, and their lights are still on, my friend.
And you're hoping to expand this program, aren't you?
Yes, sir. God has blessed us. You got people like Scott Volstead, Orlando Owens, and Paul Chamberlain. Right now we're in Green Bay. We're in Wausau. We're out there by Chippewa Falls, up by you guys almost. We got a little veteran thing going on out there in Chippewa Falls. We're in Madison, and, of course, we're right here in Milwaukee.
All right. Pastor Jerome Smith, Sr., thank you for joining us. Pastor Jerome Smith, Sr. has to leave us. He is pastor at Greater Praise Church of God in Christ in Milwaukee, co-founder of the Joseph Project. Pastor, thank you so much. We're talking this hour about Juneteenth. The celebration is June 19th, next Tuesday. And we're also talking about the greater issues of race in Western Wisconsin and some of the challenges that are unique to that are facing people of color. Salika Duxworth Lawton.
Can I jump in and say that the majority of African Americans in this country are not on public assistance? The majority of people who are on public assistance are actually white. There is the stereotype that we are, and I don't want that to be left here. There's been a long history of self-help in the black community. My mother was a vice president for the National Urban League in New Orleans, which provided Head Start 0-3, pregnancy prevention programs, et cetera, through private-public partnerships, both with churches and with government agencies. So there's a place for private entities. There's a place for public entities. But there has always been self-help in the black community.
Duly noted. And wasn't trying to infer otherwise.
No. I just wanted to make sure your listeners heard that and understood that.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you, Pastor Jerome Smith, Sr. We're going to take our first break on the west side. We'll be back with more. Still joining us for the rest of the hour is Carrie Kincaid, Eau Claire City Council President, who's going to be reading a proclamation at the celebration in Eau Claire on Tuesday for Juneteenth. Nevaeh Lambert is a junior at Memorial High School here in Eau Claire, and she's also a board member with the advocacy group Uniting Bridges. And Salika Duxworth Lawton Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton is a history professor specializing in U.S. social history, African-American history, and military history at UW-Eau Claire. We'll be right back.
Support for WPR comes from Friends of the 400 State Trail, celebrating 25 years since the trail's opening. 22 miles of wildlife and recreation from Reedsburg to Elroy. Information is at 400statetrail.org.
The Summer Food Service Program provides nutritious meals to children during the summer when free and reduced-price school meals are typically unavailable. Meals will be served Monday through Friday, June 11th through July 13th in Hilltop Center on the UW-Eau Claire campus.
I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio Stations 88.3 WHWC and 88.7 WRFW. We're talking this hour about Juneteenth. It's a celebration celebrating the end of slavery in the Confederate States, which happened 2.5 years after the proclamation, the Emancipation Proclamation, went into effect officially. So we're also talking about race in western Wisconsin and the U.S. as a whole. Some of the special challenges facing black people, people of color, that a lot of their white neighbors might not experience. Joining me in the studio is Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, history professor at UW-Eau Claire. Nevaeh Lambert is a junior at Memorial High School here in Eau Claire and a member of the advocacy or board member with the group Uniting Bridges. And Carrie Kincaid is the Eau Claire City Council president. 1-800-228-5615 if you've got a question or a comment. 1-800-228-5615. So let's run down a little bit about what we can expect at the event in Eau Claire, shall we?
Yes.
So I'll go to you, Dr. Duxworth-Lawton. Who do we have on tap? I saw some of the speakers, and I'm familiar with, you know, Dana Wachs is a local
attorney. Dana Wachs has had to pull out because he has a conflict. We will have welcomes by Joe Luganbill. The opening prayer is Reverend Tim Hallett, Birch Street Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
The proclamations, Chair Kincaid from City Council, Nick Smear. Did I pronounce his name right? From the County Board. We have students who will be reading parts of the Emancipation Proclamation. We have an officer, police officer, Officer Chaz Walton will be reading the General Granger Order to the slaves. Warren Petrick will be Representative Warren Petrick will be singing. He'll probably say something. He usually does.
Mm-hmm.
Our keynote speaker is Dale Taylor, who's Professor Emeritus from the Department of Music Therapy at UW-Eau Claire, and he will be speaking about stereotyping rights and responsibilities. And then we'll have food, which is free, open to the public, and IRESOL. We are partnering this year with ACLU, Chippewa Valley Museum, and Chippewa Valley Votes. Chippewa Valley Votes will be aiding people in registering to vote. ACLU will be providing information about their activities and about your rights. Chippewa Valley Museum, Eau Claire School of Music will be there as well. And the Eau Claire School of Music will, I think they're building instruments and they're teaching kids how to play.
Oh, fun.
And they'll do an instrument petting zoo. Chippewa Valley Museum will have a number of artifacts out and they will have sort of an artifact petting zoo. I'm not exactly sure how it's going to work. So there's a lot of things for kids. We also have several tables from other partners coming up. I'd especially like to thank UW-Eau Claire's Learning Technology Services and Chancellor's Office because they're providing the Wi-Fi that we need in order to bring this out, along with the City of Eau Claire and the Chippewa Valley Technical College, who has been partnering with us for years in helping to do this. And Uniting Bridges, I'm the vice president of Uniting Bridges, is the organizer for the city.
Time and place, please. It's going to be June 19th, obviously.
Tuesday, June 19th, 5:30. Be there.
All right.
Be there.
And where again? It's going to be Pine Pavilion?
Pine Pavilion, Carson Park. It's the pavilion that's closest to the parking lot. You'll see the big
banner.
There will be a lot of people. Last year, we had a little over 320 people. We had over 500 at the Martin Luther King this year, so we're preparing for 500 people this year.
Cool.
And when you consider that there's only 700 African Americans in Eau Claire, that tells you almost half of the people who we will be welcoming will not be African American.
Sure.
So this is a celebration here in Eau Claire of our diversity, but also of our welcome and our openness.
Inclusivity all around. 1-800-228-5615 if you've got a question or a comment. I wanted to talk about, you know, some of the issues that kind of bring to the forefront that racism is still, whether it's express or implicit or kind of by accident, it's still a big part of northern Wisconsin, just in the U.S. in general. This has to do with Sterling Brown, a Milwaukee Bucks player, got a lot of attention. He was tased by Milwaukee police officers early January 26th at a Walgreens parking lot. Initial reports by the officers claimed that Brown was being aggressive with them, but when body cam video was released, it showed that Brown seemed to remain calm and was eventually brought to the ground and tased. Further video footage showed that responding officers were feared a media firestorm after they found out that Brown was a professional basketball player. So what does this video tell you about, you know, how the officers acted, or just what does it tell you in general, Salika?
We've been trying to prevent that in Eau Claire by working with the police and for training.
Yeah.
One of the problems Milwaukee has, and yeah, they're not going to like me saying this, they don't train the way they're supposed to. A number of those officers have not done implicit bias. They haven't done de-escalation. We've done that training up here. But also what you're seeing in Milwaukee, and you see in a number of these big urban environment police departments, is just a singular lack of respect. What you saw with the Sterling Brown case gets back to what I was saying earlier about the issue for professional people being false accusation. Because without cameras, people would have believed. Here in Eau Claire, Uniting Bridges has been working both with the Technical College and with the Eau Claire Police and with the Eau Claire Area School District on cultural competency training and implicit bias training. And I'd like to shout out Judy Anibus for having a number of us go through her classes at the Tech, and shout out Chief Jerry Staniszewski for making it very clear he's not going to tolerate this. Do we still get what's called a DWB, driving while black? Do people still get pulled over for it? Yes. Do we still have issues of stereotyping here? Yes. But what happened to Sterling Brown would be a lot harder to get away with here. That, what you saw is what ill-trained, inexperienced officers do when they stereotype. But it's also an abuse of power. They thought they could get away with it because they thought this was someone who had no power. When they found out they had just beaten a celebrity, and that meant that the video was going to be released, all of a sudden, oh my God, I'm afraid. They were afraid they were going to get caught.
Yeah.
And that's why we have to be very careful about how we screen police to make sure that these are police who want to serve the community and treat people with respect. I've said several times in public that the first time my mother, a black woman from Louisiana, was treated respectfully by police was when I was pulled over when I was pregnant with my 11-year-old here in Eau Claire. My husband has mentioned several times, and my husband has, we've had what's called racism by proxy, which is where people call the police on people because they are black. I've actually disabled Nextdoor on my phone because I got tired of seeing it on Nextdoor. My husband is a black man. He's a black belt. He practices at Irving Park in Chippewa Falls. There's been a number of interesting drive-bys for that. And Nextdoor, black man walking through the neighborhood. Well, yeah, heck, that's my brother, that's my son, and that's my husband. But the police, as he's pointed out, have always been respectful to him. And they've always been polite. Now, he hasn't always been happy with the outcome, but they've always been respectful and polite. That's the difference here in Eau Claire. that you don't see in Milwaukee, and those police need to be fired. I'm going to be real honest, because the only way they will learn to be respectful, polite, and to actually do their job is if some of them actually lose their job over it and keep that job lost. Right now, the Supreme Court has gutted most of the accountability laws at the federal level. That's why it's important for legislators to keep accountability laws at the state level so that we will have police we can trust. You can't clear a murder in New Orleans, my home city. You can't clear a murder in Chicago. You're having problems clearing murders in Milwaukee, because would you really, if you were a black person, trust that group to come in your house? So the black community actually underutilizes police, even as it is over-policed. And I've had that experience here where I really should have called the police, but I have not, because I have been raised, you don't call the police because that may escalate the situation against you. You may be accused of something.
Nevaeh Lambert, I wanted to ask you, you know, phones, everything, everybody's got a camera in their pocket. Do you think that the availability of cameras, whether they be in the hands of bystanders or required to be worn by police officers, do you think that's actually changing anything with how law enforcement deals with black people?
I think it is, but I also think there's that factor that people aren't going to believe what they actually see, that the video's been tampered with, or that it's not what really happened, and that was a different scenario, and it's not what actually happened. But I do think in some cases that it could help. On police officers, yes. Bystanders, again, it's that whole, like, what went down before or after the situation. But I really do think that the videos would help, or at least, like, help a little bit.
Sure. And I'm not sure if the discussion has ever been had in the city to have our local police here in the city or the sheriff's department wear body cams. Is that, Council President Kincaid, is that something that's been discussed?
It has been discussed. If I might speak with as much accuracy as possible.
Please do.
In our community, it's a budget issue.
Yeah, I'm sure.
They're
it's
very
expensive.
And I think we have a few, and they're worn under some sort of protocol.
Sure.
But very few. But mostly it's a budgetary issue.
Sure.
But if I might say in the larger context that, so the reality in Eau Claire is that I and most of the city council and most of the police force actually belong to the dominant class, the majority race. And we are, our responsibility then is to constantly learn, to develop trust, to act with high standard, to show respect and the, I forget the name of the implicit bias training, which I'm proud to say that our police force does engage in routinely and has a high expectation of greeting the crime, the incident, in full knowledge as possible. What happened here, what did happen here, what's happening here, what's going to happen here, who's involved, and learning to absorb all of those facts, not in a blind way, but in an educated way and a proud way that the policemen and women are professionals and they should greet their job as professionals. So for us, the body cam, I don't know the answer. I think I agree with you as far as video doesn't mean truth.
No.
And particularly
sure.
Now, maybe
yeah.
In your
and
generation.
I think Eau Claire doesn't necessarily need it now, but it's that possibility that in the future, the chance of it going up being needed. And
maybe.
The fact that we have at least a couple makes it a little bit easier to catch those certain things. So.
Yeah, I think it's I think I'm not stretching too much to say it is an aspiration of our police force in order to increase accountability and that professionalism, knowing that it's not a perfect, it's
right.
As you said, you know.
Video. Oh, go ahead.
It also protects the police officer. Mm-hmm. There was a recent case where a police officer was falsely accused of raping a woman in his car, and it was the body cam footage that proved that that did not happen, and she had to apologize. And she's lost her law license, I think, because of that. So that was literally last week. Mm. So body cams work both ways. They protect the public and they provide accountability to the public. But they also provide protection to the police officers. You know, our country has a problem with false accusation, and we really have to start grappling with it.
Yeah. There must be strict protocol or procedure, I should say, right?
Yeah.
If you get a body cam, you just don't hook it on and there you go.
Yeah.
There's lots to learn.
There's a lot of rules. And also there have been issues also with, like, law enforcement agencies being willing to release said video. That's a whole other ball of wax that the media and others have dealt with. But we need to take our final break here on the West Side. Still a lot more things to talk about. We're talking about Juneteenth. We're using that as kind of a jumping off point to talk about race in Eau Claire and the greater Chippewa Valley, western Wisconsin area. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call at 1-800-228-5615. I'm joined by Nevaeh Lambert. She's a junior at Memorial High School and a board member with Uniting Bridges. Salika Duxworth-Lawton is a history professor specializing in U.S. social history, African-American history, and military history at UW-Eau Claire. She's the vice president of Uniting Bridges. And Carrie Kincaid is the Eau Claire City Council president and one of the people that are going to be issuing a proclamation on behalf of the city to the attendees and at the event, the Juneteenth event, which is happening Tuesday at 5:30 in Carson Park. This is the West Side.
Celebrate summer and support WPR at Crayfish Summerfest, a one-of-a-kind dining experience at Al Johnson's Restaurant in Door County. Hi, I'm Maureen McCollum. Join Lori Skelton and me on August 16th for traditional Swedish food and drink, including crayfish, summer vegetables, and strawberry cardamom shortbread, along with live music and good friends. That's Crayfish Summerfest at Al Johnson's in Sister Bay. Get tickets and details at WPR.org/presents.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Association and the new Alumni Park, featuring exhibits that honor the Wisconsin idea, lakefront green space, and a variety of events and activities. More at alumnipark.com.
The Summer Food Service Program provides nutritious meals to children during the summer when free and reduced price school meals are typically unavailable. Meals will be served Monday through Friday, June 11th through July 13th in Hilltop Center on the UW-Eau Claire campus.
You're listening to The West Side. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking about Juneteenth. It's a celebration of the final abolition of slavery in the Confederate States, which happened more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was enacted. The event, there's an event in Eau Claire, and they're happening all over the place, but an event in Eau Claire Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. in Carson Park. It's a celebration of the, and a commemoration of the actual freeing of the slaves, but it's much more than that. It's also a celebration of unity and a gathering of people in the city. So check that out. We're also talking, using that as a jumping off point to talk about the greater issues of race and racism, implicit bias, you name it, in our region. 1-800-228-5615 is the number to call. I'm joined by Dr. Salika Duxworth-Lawton, a professor at UW-Eau Claire, Nevaeh Lambert, a junior at Memorial High School and a board member of Uniting Bridges, and Carrie Kincaid, Eau Claire City Council President. If you've got a question or a comment, please let us have it. We will be glad to take your call, and it always adds to the conversation. 1-800-228-5615. So I try not to make these kind of programs too political, but there have been a lot of things relating that the president has said with regard to black people and race in general. One example is the NFL national anthem protests, which have been going on for at least 2 years, I think, where players will take a knee. They are protesting. They say they're protesting police brutality and also just racism and inequality in general. Some people on the right have taken that and used it to say that the players are disrespecting the flag, the nation, troops, etc. So it's become a political issue. The president has kind of taken that opinion that it seems to be a disrespectful sort of display. And the NFL recently, the owners unanimously approved a new policy that requires players to stand if they are on the field during the performance. But they are allowed to remain in the locker room if they prefer. So, Salika, I'm going to start with you. First of all, the NFL policy, problem solved, right?
When the NFL bans Confederate flags, we'll talk. If we're going to talk about disrespect to the American flag, the Confederate flag represents 450,000 American deaths. American deaths protecting our flag. Confederates killed more Americans than World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Desert Storm 1, Desert Storm 2. Every war of the 20th century plus the Spanish-American War. So we're going to have a cow over them kneeling to the flag, which soldiers have done to bring attention to things, which athletes have done in the past. But we're not going to talk about the actual disrespect to the flag.
I mean, I'm
there's hypocrisy here.
The NFL does. What do you mean? Like people bringing the Confederate flag
people
into the stadium?
People wear Confederate flag shirts at the
okay,
stadium.
I see what you're saying.
I'm from Louisiana. I'm a Saints fan. I've seen Confederate flags at football games.
Sure.
I mean, that's a whole big issue in the South. I've seen Confederate shirts. But if you're going to allow that, but you're going to ban kneeling, you look hypocritical. On top of that, no, it doesn't change it because the issue of police brutality still stands. As long as football players, and realize Sterling Brown is the fourth athlete in a two-week period to be wrongfully roughed up. As long as that's happening to these athletes, they're going to use their platform to be able to advertise it. They may not do it on the field, but the guy from the NBA who was doing the postcards, the big giant cards, got his message across. You know, so this isn't going to make it better because the underlying issue is still there. We have to focus on behavior. A number of the majority of whites will be victimized by whites. The majority of blacks will be victimized by blacks because we live in a segregated society. And if you are so busy being afraid of black people that you do all of this, you will allow yourself to be hurt by white people. And the irony is there's been a bunch of giant white segregationists. I'm thinking of Jeff Berry, who was the head of the American Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. While he was screaming about black people, Latinos, and Jews, the people who put him in the hospital were members of his own Klan. Mm. And they stole his money. So when people talk about race and when they do these kind of things like the NFL is doing, you should put your hand on your wallet because they're trying to distract you from who actually is close to you, who can actually hurt you. The majority of African Americans in this country do not have a criminal record, are gainfully employed, over 73%. But if you look at the media, if you look at the stereotyping, and if you look at some of these tweets, you wouldn't know that. You wouldn't understand that.
So having the president weigh in on this, and also after the Charlottesville, the tragic situation there where a woman lost her life and during a clash between white nationalist groups, white supremacist groups, and counter-protesters. The president, you know, blamed both sides famously and also said that there were plenty of fine people on both sides. A lot of people kind of saw that as him sticking up for white supremacists. I'm just wondering, Nevaeh Lambert, I'll go to you. he's the president of the United States. We're taught all through school to respect the office, respect the person. So what goes through your head when you see stuff like this?
In a way, I wish he would have more of a view, because I feel like he's a very close-minded man. And I'm going to say I respect every president that goes to the office, no matter how much personal hate I have for them, because I live in a country, they give me my rights, they have. But I just wish he would have more of a view on black lives, because he's a white man who came from a white family of a very white area. So I feel like he just needs to have more of views on what really happens. And I feel like it's just that, like, close-minded stuff. But, yeah.
And, Salik, I'll give you the final word. We're just about out of time. But does the president's tweets or what have you, when people in high places say things or support a lot of views that some would see as racist, does that embolden people that might have that kind of inside them, but to get vocal about it?
He's turned over a number of rocks, and it's not just here, it's also abroad as well. I was in London at a conference for Chatham House, the Royal Society for International Affairs, this past February, and I got a lot of questions, not just about American race relations, but about how this rhetoric actually can be contagious. One of the things we have to understand is when you normalize racists and you allow them to speak, you embolden them to act. So while we believe in free speech, we have to meet this with more speech.
And with that, I want to thank our guests for their discussion this hour. Carrie Kincaid is Eau Claire City Council President. Salika Duxworth-Lawton is a history professor at UW-Eau Claire and Vice President of Uniting Bridges. Nevaeh Lambert is a junior at Memorial High School and a board member for Uniting Bridges. And also Pastor Jerome Smith Sr. is a pastor who joined us by phone. He's a pastor of Greater Praise Church of God in Christ in Milwaukee and founder of the Joseph Project. Have a safe and productive week. Thanks to Team Westside. We'll chat again next Monday morning.